The last case in our calendar is 1138 Columbus Bar Association versus Lawrence. Edward Winkfield, Mr. Matthews.
May it please the court, the Chief Justice, Justices. My name is Alvin Matthews, and I'm here on behalf of Lawrence Winkfield, who is present in the courtroom today with his wife. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
This is a case about judging intent and whether or not the conduct alleged was willful. As this court knows, the main issue is whether or not an indefinite suspension should be the sanction regarding the respondent's license in this case.
And that's dependent on what he did or didn't do. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you have a copy of your brief there in front of you, Mr. Matthews? Can you get it, please?
I have it, yes.
Would you turn to page 15, footnote 8? Because I wanted to be sure this is part of the record, let's you and I go over it.
Okay.
There is no finding that Mr. Winkfield did not cooperate with the Columbus Bar Association in the Lowry matter. In fact, Mr. Winkfield had reached a tentative understanding with the Columbus Bar Association that the Lowry matter would not be prosecuted upon the fulfillment of certain conditions. The delay in satisfying the conditions led to the formal complaint. That's your assertion to this court?
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, as I understand the facts, Mr. Winkfield, after he had been contacted originally about this complaint, probably by somebody, an investigator from the Bar Association, took the $7,000 and took it to Judge Wright. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. The full $7,000.
Yes.
In the record, there are a couple of letters from Judge Wright. One of them sends back to Mr. Lowry $5,200. Where'd the other $1,800 go? I want to know if Mr. Winkfield got $1,800 back.
I believe he did, Your Honor, but that's not part of the record in this case. I don't believe in the testimony, but I believe...
What the testimony is, and I've gone over every page of it, that he gave the full $7,000 to his then lawyer, Mr. Wright.
Yes, sir.
And then that $1,800 just suddenly disappears. Doesn't say that he got it back. Doesn't say where it went. Would you like to consult with him and ask him if he got the $1,800?
I will.
I want to know. Original stipulation and the complaint specifically say that the money was taken to Mr. Wright and that the $7,000 your client testified was to be returned to Mr. Lowry pursuant to a conversation. He knew who to return it to because Mr. Sherman was involved in the conversation. Is that right?
That's what he testified to in the record.
Okay. The stipulation, in fact, number 9, says that in October 98, approximately 14 months after demand for the accounting return of retainer, respondent turned over $7,000, representing the Lowry retainer, to his then counsel, that would be Mr. Wright, that 7 months later, in May of 99, his counsel paid $5,200 of the $7,000 retainer to Mr. Lowry with a letter of explanation concerning the retention of the $1,800. That's a stipulation.
Yes.
Both sides agreed to that.
Yes, sir.
So both sides in this case know where that $1,800 went.
Yes, sir.
Think that's a violation of anything of our rules?
Well, certainly a lawyer, when he or she works on a case, can keep their time for the case and ascertain whether or not they earned funds.
But your representation to us is that this case would not be here with a very serious sanction proposed by the board, that this case would not be here had there not been a delay from October until May of the next year of the return of the money that he took to his attorney that his attorney didn't send on. Isn't that your representation to us?
Well, my understanding is that they had reached some resolution that if the money were returned promptly, that the case would not be here. That's my understanding of that.
Okay, just one or two more questions then. What our report says, among others, is the panel finds that respondent's conduct by clear and convincing evidence violated 102A6, conduct reflecting on a fitness to practice. This is about Mr. Wingfield now. A3, neglecting an entrusted matter. A1, failing to seek the lawful objectives of the client. A2, failing to carry out a contract of employment. If that's true of Mr. Wingfield, would it not also be true of Mr. Wright?
I haven't analyzed that, sir.
Thank you. I'll ask the Bar Association.
Okay. With regard to the issues that we want to present, number one, relative to the retainer, the issue is, did Mr. Wingfield take $7,000 from the Lowry family knowing that he couldn't obtain a result from the Lowry family? And it's our suggestion that when Mr. Wingfield took the funds, he took it to investigate what remedies were available. In fact, there are letters in the file, there are letters in the record that show that was what he was hired to do. And so we would respectfully suggest that the panel and the board's determination that Mr. Wingfield was somehow deceptive to the Lowry family is incorrect in this case. And in our brief, we talked about the manner in which solo practitioners are disproportionately disciplined, and the manner in which lawyers are challenged in their practices by other extraneous situations. And we didn't do that to suggest, as the relator responded in their brief, that lawyers should escape responsibility because they're solo practitioners or because they have problems or challenges in their practice. We argued that to suggest that the panel, the board, nor this court should think the worst about lawyers. That shouldn't be our first reaction. Our first reaction should be to look at the intent, to look at the surrounding circumstances, and to judge the intent of the lawyer. What was Mr. Wingfield's intent here? And the record clearly shows, from the letters that were written and looking at the surrounding circumstances, we can't read his mind, but looking at the surrounding circumstances, the record shows that he took $7,000 to handle this post-conviction matter. And the letter indicates that there are various things that he's going to investigate. And he, in fact, starts to do that. He talked with the trial counsel. He received and reviewed the file. He found out there was a defense specification. And then he also talked with the family. So those are some things that he initially did. But he has stipulated in this case that he didn't carry out the representation, that he didn't do what he should have done. And that is the problem we see with the board's findings and conclusions relative to somehow deceiving the Lowry family. He's acknowledged that he was wrong. And then when he goes into the hearing room and he testifies, and they're right, This system is set up for the panels and the board to judge credibility and how the witness comes across. But after a lawyer admits that I didn't do what I was supposed to do on a case and I took $7,000 and it took me some time to pay it back, what good explanation can you come up with? The catch-22 situation.
But the point, I guess, Count Mr. Matthews, is that when, I mean, that's one of the very most serious offense we have as lawyers is to abuse the fiduciary trust that we have, particularly with regard to clients' money. And so this is a, you know, this is, that's a disbarment. You take money, now it's a disbarment, unless there's mitigating, you know, factors. So, I mean, it's not a question of what you, can you say. You've said you're sorry, but it reflects on your fitness to practice in a profession that requires the highest honesty to protect the public.
I'm glad you mentioned that about stealing money, but those are not the facts here.
Yeah.
There are no facts here about a lawyer stealing money.
I imagine that these clients, though, might feel differently because that's a lot of money for this particular lawyer. He said he wasn't used to getting that kind of retainer. So, and I gather from the evidence it was a whole lot of money to the people who put it up, the defendant's family. And, you know, so one would expect that the lawyer entrusted with a bulk of money like he hasn't received from other clients would, in, I would think, give, that would be the case he'd give a lot of attention to.
Well, he made a mistake and he admitted it, but the point is here that the records show, the fee agreement or engagement letter, show that he took $7,000, he said he was going to charge $150 an hour. He never told these people that this is a non-refundable retainer or I'm not going to give you money back. We see that in cases. We see cases where lawyers take bigger sums and never pay it back.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, we have a lawyer who takes $7,000 and who says he's going to do a job, for whatever reason, doesn't get around to finishing it, but eventually hires counsel, gets the money together, and attempts to pay it back or pays a substantial portion of it back. And that's the key here. It's not a case of stealing. And to suggest that this is a case of stealing, a case of disbarment, a case of indefinite suspension, we think is quite harsh in this case. An indefinite suspension, as this court knows, requires a lawyer to serve a suspension of a minimum of 2 years. And in effect, it's a minimum of 3 years because we know the procedure that you have to go through to prove fitness takes a while. You got to go through a new hearing and prove that you're fit to practice. This man has practiced law for 25 years now. He has never had any disciplinary problem through 21 years of practice. We would respectfully urge that this is not a person who should be indefinitely suspended under these facts. The key is that he stipulated many things in this case. And we see that our time is running, and we would like to reserve some time for rebuttal in anticipation of the related argument. So we'll reserve the remainder.
Thank you, Mr. Matthews. Mr. Sherman.
Good morning. My name is Terry Sherman. I'm here on behalf of the Professional Ethics Committee of the Columbus Bar Association. I am a sole practitioner and have been one for more than 20 years, and my practice is criminal defense. And at the outset, I'd like to say, as a sole practitioner, I do not want a double standard. I do not want to be held to a lower standard of competency. I think sole practitioners do a good or better job than the lawyers in the big firm, and I don't want to be treated any differently, and I don't want my ethical conduct to be held to any lower standard.
Counsel, was it your panel or your
level that recommended the 2-year length of stay? Your Honor, when we entered the stipulation case prior to the hearing before the three-panel commissioners, As part of the stipulation, we agreed to a joint recommendation of 2 years with 1 year stay and 1 year suspension.
Okay. Now, you as a private practitioner also know that the criminal defense work will take detainers to investigate cases, correct?
Your Honor, every day of my career, I get calls about shock probation and shock parole. Many of those in one phone call, I have to tell people there is no legal remedy. Yes, I do take retainers, and in those retainers, I write a contract, and in that contract, I spell out in great detail as to what I can do, and if I find that the individual is ineligible, I will immediately notify him. Mr. Wingfield's been practicing criminal law for 26 years. Doesn't take a brain surgeon to look at, the first thing you're going to look at is the sentencing entry, and as soon as you look at that sentencing entry, you had to know, and he admitted in his deposition that he knew that person was ineligible for any type of early release. Now, he wrote a letter in June. Now, he gets her a $7,000 retainer in February 97. He writes a letter in June of 97, that's 4 months later, clearly more than enough time to walk a few minutes to the courthouse and look at the file, and he says in that letter that I can get you a motion for reduction of sentence, a motion to withdraw guilty plea, a motion for shock probation. None of those are viable. There's no such thing as a motion for reduction of sentence unless it's an illegal motion to withdraw guilty plea. 4 years later, give me a break. A motion for shock, it's 4 months' time. He had to know that this person was convicted of two specs. There was a gun spec and there was a prior crime spec, which made it an actual incarceration on two separate grounds. There's no way that person was eligible for any type of early release.
So he admits he's wrong. He admits he gave bad legal advice. He gives the $7,000 to another attorney.
15 months later.
15 months later. Okay, so say 15 months later. What happens then? What's the breakdown?
Well, the breakdown, in my opinion, the breakdown number one is first of all, he took the money when he shouldn't have. Number two, about knowing that the person was ineligible, he had an obligation to immediately notify the family. Number three, when they terminated him and asked for an accounting of legal services, he should immediately give a accounting of legal services to refund the money, which he didn't do. Number four,
he didn't give it to an attorney to do that.
Well,
right then.
Not right then. The Craig Wright issue didn't come back. So I got in this case. I investigated. I got in this case in August of 98. Craig Wright didn't get the money until October of 98. And in fact, I think I was in the case before August of 98. So the money didn't come to Craig Wright until before. There was an effort by the family, an effort to get a hold of Mr. Wingfield to get him to make restitution. Additionally, he commingled his funds. He took this money and didn't put it in the trust. He kind of used it right away. He used unearned fees. He couldn't account for it, and he couldn't explain in any way. And he had no bookkeeping system of how this money was handled.
Do you have a date when you did get engaged? And as I understand it, Mr. Campbell contacted you to handle this case.
I was on the professional ethics committee. I was assigned to do the investigation. I believe it was in August of 98, I filed a report with the committee, and I've got to tell you that I believe that we never told Mr. Wingfield that if he paid the $7,000, we would totally forget about it. We said that would weigh heavily in how we were to proceed and what recommendations we would make to the committee. The committee would vote, and from there we would go on. But
so he was clearly under some cloud of suspicion at that point, knew it. Wasn't it a logical thing for him to go to a lawyer?
When I first interviewed him, I interviewed him in August of 97, and I had some trouble getting a hold of him. Finally, when I got a hold of him, he wasn't represented at that time.
Do you remember when you first contacted Mr. Wright?
I believe Mr. Wright contacted me by phone as to where the money was, sometime after where the money should be sent.
Would have been before or after the May 5, 1999, Dear Bruce letter?
I believe it would have been before.
Uh-huh. So he contacted
Mr.
Campbell from the Bar Association as opposed to even contacting somebody who was doing the investigating. All right, then he writes the letter saying, this is not Mr. Wingfield's fault. He made restitution, but his lawyer failed to pass on the funds to the proper individual, who's one Samaki Walker. By the way, the issue came up about money. Is that the pro basketball player
that
we know about?
Samaki Walker is the brother of Frederick Lowry, who was the defendant who was incarcerated in the Klein Misery.
So not that $7,000 is not a large sum, but it wouldn't have been any problem for him, as I recall his contract, to be advancing $7,000 on behalf of his brother, would it have?
Well, I don't know about that, Your Honor. I do know that these people felt that they were they were violated by the lawyer they trusted to do their legal work.
Right, and that's what happened. Mr. Lowry actually wrote a letter back to Mr. Wright, didn't he? Telling him that.
Now,
this is the reason I started looking at all this, because the panel, for some reason, inserted that paragraph in that report that didn't seem to have any relevance to it, and it looked to me like a message was being sent.
The panel was perplexed by the missing $1,800 as to why that money was deducted from the Lowry family, and they didn't understand, number one, that the money was... basically, Mr. Wingfield admitted through his deposition and others that he didn't do a thing. And they couldn't understand why later on down the line they turned around and deducted $1,800 without any kind of accounting, without anything, and according to Mr. Wingfield, without his approval. That's what perplexed him.
Well, wait, Mr. Wingfield had to think that he wasn't entitled to it, or he wouldn't take the full $7,000 to his attorney. And to there, I want to go to the next step. You're arguing that he is very culpable because 4 months period of time was long enough for him to walk across to the courthouse and do all that. How many months, and I'll help you if you don't know, is 7 to 8 months, did Mr. Wright keep that and not do what his client instructed him to do?
I'm not really in a position to talk about Mr. Wright and what he did or should have done and what he didn't do. I'm not here to tell you that Mr. Wright, in my opinion, had some issues, and I believe that that is really not a part of what's going on here, because...
Well, I think it is.
Well, then you...
I think it is. And I need to know, because it looks to me like if we're going to charge him, and you are, with all of these matters, conduct reflecting on a fitness to practice, neglecting an entrusted matter, failing to seek the lawful objectives of a client, I mean, it reads, the litany reads about the same, does it not? And my concern is that we have an obligation to report when we think there's been a clear violation of the disciplinary rules. Have you done that in this case?
Have I reported
Have you filed any grievance against Mr. Wright?
Your Honor, I understand, well, first of all, as I understand it, the rules of this court are not allowed to speak about that, correct? That any investigation not formalized is not to be spoken by any participant in the professional
education. Mr. Wright's activities in delaying the return of that money in any way prejudiced Mr. Wingfield, even a little? It did, Mr. Sherman, didn't it?
I don't, in my opinion, and I'm not standing up for Justice Wright, in my opinion, that doesn't sway me. What swayed me is the fact that this man appeared before you in 96, and one of your justices pointed out that he appeared without remorse and was unwilling to accept responsibility for his actions, and there was a prediction, I believe, by Justice Cook that he'd be back. And sure enough, he came back, and he still doesn't have any remorse, he still doesn't have any repentance, and he still doesn't accept responsibility for his conduct.
It's not the way I read his testimony before the panel.
That's the way the panel interpreted, you know. They were there, and that's, I believe, the way they interpreted his testimony, his attempt to find fault with everybody but himself. Your Honor, these people look to Mr. Wingfield. They looked to him for guidance. He gave them hope. There was a man in prison who Mr. Wingfield gave hope that he could do something for. They waited with utmost patience. They consulted with other lawyers and said there was no legal remedy. And Mr. Wingfield said there was, so they wanted to believe him. Mr. Wingfield did no zero legal work in this case.
Let me ask you the question that seemed to me to be pretty important. It's one of timing. Do we know, I can't tell from the stipulations, do we know what Mr. Wingfield knew about Mr. Lowry, the Lowry that's in prison, what he knew about his situation when he took the $7,000. Had he done any investigating at that point, or did the family members tell Mr. Wingfield about the gun spec or that sort of thing?
I believe I don't know when he took the money in February, what he knew and what he didn't know. However, anybody who's been practicing criminal law for 25 years would know that if there's an aggravated robbery conviction, the first question you're going to ask is was there a gun spec.
Well, but the claim is that he intentionally took money from them, intending not to do any work, as I understand from Mr. Matthews.
The claim is he took the money, he kept the money, he did no legal work, he never...
Well, I understand that, but that's a different issue from whether he took the money knowing that he was not going to do any work. Those are two different issues, are they not?
I don't believe that it was ever our intention. Our intention is he took the money, he kept the money. When he was terminated, he didn't account for the money, he didn't account for his hours. To this day, I don't believe he ever made an accounting for his hours. And to this day, I don't believe the Lauer family ever got any itemized accounting as to hours of work. I don't believe that Mr. Wingfield ever did any legal work.
All they got was a letter from Mr. Wright.
Correct.
Sending him $5,200 with some, I don't want to use the word contorted, but I sure had trouble figuring out the second paragraph of the $3,000, and that he gave a 40% discount and something. I think I finally figured it out that he figured 20 hours at $150. Which comes to $3,000, less 40% is $1,200, which leaves $1,800 he didn't get. I think that's probably what happened. Yeah. Now, what right does anybody have to do that with clients' money?
I never said, and I never will say, that was appropriate conduct or that he had a right to do that. I've never said that.
Good.
But I understand. I think we're talking about Mr. Wingfield. And also, one final thing I'd like to say, in Mr. Matthews' brief, he said no one was harmed. Well, I submit to you that Fred Lowry, who was in prison, was harmed. I submit to you that the Lowry family was harmed, that basically $7,000 was taken from them and kept from them for many, many months, and they had to go to court, and they had to come to us, and they had to go to other places to try to get their money back. And I submit to you that the legal profession as a whole, sole practitioners like myself, were harmed because these people now have a very bad taste for criminal defense lawyers. They have a very bad taste for lawyers, and they think that we're about five steps below used car salesmen. I think that Mr. Wingfield, by his conduct, harmed all of us, including this court. So,
thank you, Mr. Sherman. Mr. Matthews, you've saved almost 2 minutes of your time.
First, I'd like to point out, Your Honor, that Mr. Sherman, in this case, is a lawyer and an advocate on behalf of the Bar Association and not a witness in this case. That's number one. Number two, he didn't state their recommendation. Their recommendation was 2 years with 1 year stay. That was their recommendation. They entered into stipulations in this case regarding certain conduct. And then when the panel decides that it wants to do something different, and certainly they have a right to inquire, but when they decide that they want to add in additional violations and make additional findings, and Justice Moyer was right, there is an assertion in this case, not originally by the Bar Association and not in the stipulations, but the panel did find that Mr. Wingfield supposedly led the Lowry astray. And that's important in this case because we don't have that type of intent here that would warrant an indefinite suspension. That's the issue. The issue in this case is not whether Mr. Wingfield was wrong. He's admitted that. The issue is what sanction should he receive. That's the issue. Regarding the prior discipline and this prediction that Mr. Sherman refers to, that initial case was a somewhat novel. As you will recall, Mr. Brooks, Mr. Wingfield's former partner, was charged with misconduct. And it was Mr. Brooks' client who was actually complaining. Mr. Wingfield legitimately, and I know that he didn't seem remorseful to this court or to the panel or to the court, but legitimately believed he had a valid defense. It was his partner's client, and he didn't take the money and keep it in that particular situation. The fact, their assertion that no one that we said that no one was harmed in this case, we simply quoted from the panel's report regarding what the harm was in this case, and it was instilling false hope. That's what the panel observed. To suggest that this sweeping allegation that Mr. Wingfield has harmed the whole bar, not as much as some of the lawyers you've seen come before. You've seen much worse, and those are the lawyers that involved this bar, that deserve disbarment and indefinite suspension. I see my time is up. Thank you for your attention. If you don't have any further questions, I'd like to thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Matthews. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn court.